All right, welcome to the pod, Benjamin Robinson. I guess it's been probably about a year since the last time we talked. There's this weird thing that goes on at the end of every April and the beginning of May that every team, well, not say every team, let's say two-thirds of teams are on a path to success somehow after the NFL draft, and the other ones are complete failures. And we know that immediately right after the draft happens, correct?
Yeah, all they have to do is read the Unexpected Point Substack and look at the grades that you do, and I think that pretty much tells them exactly what happened.
Yeah, that does. Yeah, it sounds like, I don't know. I don't know what happened. Although I would have been pretty harsh on the Detroit Lions, and let me tell you, a lot of victory lapping going on in that front office here. So maybe some humble pie. We'll come to those guys.
I mean, they almost made the Super Bowl. So, you know.
That is true. They almost made the Super Bowl. At the same point in time, like, I mean, this is what we're talking about a lot of the drafts. Of like, how much credit do you get for getting, you know, Aiden Hutchinson because the Jags decided to pull an audible and go for Walker instead and all that sort of stuff.
I mean, my feeling is, you know what really put them over the top? Jack Campbell and Jahmyr Gibbs. Without them, this never would have happened. It wasn't Jared Goff having an above average year, their offensive line really gelling together, you know, the defense and the down year in the rest of their division. It had nothing to do with that.
No.
And I like the Lions, but I feel like I have to, you know, they deserve some pats on the back for some of their second round selections. Some of their first round selections were a little questionable.
Yeah, I mean, I think like the going all the way back to the golf.
They listened to you on Sam Laporta, you know? Sam Laporta.
I guess if they truly would have listened to me, though, they probably would have missed him. That's the problem.
First
the
round, problem is, we won't listen to Kevin. Second round, we're going all in on Unexpected Points.
The problem is people are like buying into the tight end stuff that I love so much. I mean, let's just, okay, so anyway, grinding the mocks, I'll have all the links in here, the work you're doing, all that sort of stuff. Should we preface it now? Let's give them a little taste of everything that you're doing over there. They've probably, if they're reading the Substack, they've looked at the consensus mock drafts, which are all powered by your data. But give me your elevator pitch here, and then we can get into the details of stuff.
Yeah, so Grinding the Mocks is all about predicting the NFL draft using the Wisdom of Crowds mock draft and data science. I haven't gone full blown artificial intelligence yet, but yeah.
You'd get a lot more funding if you did.
Maybe. So basically, you know, our motto is, you know, we really believe that, you know, in social sciences, that the power of the wisdom of crowds is really important, and it's proven to be right over the six drafts. This will be my sixth draft doing Grinding the Mocks data collection and analysis. And we've proven to be really accurate and stable over time, which is, I think, really hard to do. It's really hard to have a process that produces consistent results every year. And, you know, we also track the NFL draft in terms of performance really well. So, you know, if my feeling is that if you want to kind of know about what's about to happen before the draft, you look at the data, and my data does a really good job. I have about an 85% success rate of picking the players that will end up in the first round. So that means about 27 of the 32 players that get picked in the first round will show up in my top 32. In 2022, that was 30. Last year, it was 26. But on average, it's about 27. So we do a really good job, I think, of kind of just showing people, hey, like, this is where the crowd is aligned when it comes to the draft.
Okay, so a couple different things on methodology. First, who are we taking these mocks from? Are we taking them from I think I read somewhere from ESPN on their mock draft simulator that one particular Bears fan had done like 900 mock drafts or something of that nature. So are we getting diluted by the truly sick and the depravity of some of these people who are on there too much, number one? And number two, like, how much does how well they've done in the past matter when we're projecting some of these guys going forward? And how many guys are just going for clicks? There are some people click hunting out there when it comes to these mock drafts.
Yeah, for sure. So I source, you know, from all over the internet, but a lot from kind of football sports media, kind of fans who have shown demonstrated interest in the draft over the years, who analyze players, rank players, and think about the draft in their own way. So to me, you know, I end up with around like 2,000 or so mock drafts around each year that I collect from the beginning of the beginning of the season, draft season, technically at the end of the draft, people will start putting out their mock drafts for next year all the way through the day of the draft this year. So it really is kind of a
truly way you get the way too early mocks. You have the way too early mocks.
Yeah. There. Yeah. We can
what do some of those look like?
In theory, we should maybe do a too early consensus preseason post-draft mock draft if you want to do
that. That's a good one. Yeah. We can compare it to what we have at the end. At the
exactly.
End
of the, yeah. Exactly. It'll be very different. But the, so in terms of where I source those from, it's from all over the internet, but it's not like, I don't get the data from the mock draft simulators. I think one of the reasons that you don't want to use data from the mock draft simulators is because they mostly all use the same board. And so you're going to be biased. Like if you use the PFF draft simulator, they actually used to have an option to have my data as the public board, and they didn't have that this year. Couldn't work that out. But you'll see like Cooper DeJean really high because he's like the eighth or ninth player on their board. Well, that biases his stock to probably be a bit higher than it is because the default board places it a lot higher than usual.
Yeah.
And then in terms of
there's some nudging going on there. The drafters are getting nudged in certain directions based upon what PFF is saying. Yeah.
Yeah. And on the other side of things, I have a draft neck score that I give that's based on just kind of the pick adjusted accuracy. And this is what ends up in the adjusted mock drafts that we use in the consensus mock draft that you've done on Unexpected Points. And so we basically have a way of kind of from 0 to 1 scoring these draft nicks based on how accurate they've been relative to the, like I said, with the idea that you want to be more accurate at the top of the draft than at the bottom of the draft. And so you give a score from 1 to 0, and that kind of equates their draft nick score. And then I have another score that looks at when the mock draft was published, which is a proxy for how information rich the environment is. And so we kind of get those together, and that's ultimately how you come up with these adjusted mock drafts. And so, for example, mock drafts that are, coming out today, we are, 3 days from the draft, those are going to be rated 0.25. And so like we're only just now getting to mock drafts that really mean much in terms of the weighting in my model.
Right. Okay. So the one thing, like when I wrote this up, what I'll try to contrast the information that you're putting forth here versus most often is the betting markets, what I can find of betting markets. It's not universal. It's a little bit more particular to different books as to what the odds will be than something like a spread or a total on an NFL game. But they seem to move in the same direction. So my question would be, how do you think about that versus the markets? Because I don't know what we're going to see this year, but we've already seen some movement on the number 2 pick where it was swinging more heavily towards Jaden Daniels. And now it's maybe evening out a little bit more between him and May. And then, of course, we had, the huge shift back in 2021 when it ended up being Trey Lance for the 3rd pick and everything flipped there. So that's going to have a very big effect. And we're talking about just days before the draft, because I think that really started moving on maybe like the Monday or Tuesday before the draft that year. Whereas yours is accumulating all of this different wisdom as we're going out over time. So how do you think about the markets versus what you're doing and the accuracy early in the process to late in the process from those 2 different metrics?
So yeah, the market, I think, can do some things that the mock drafts can't do, which is react to public information fast. So normally, it takes some time for the market to absorb data, even if it has a big meaningful impact on the draft order. And so the market can react really swiftly to that. And then also you can take input from the action that you get. And I think that might be what's happening with the line that you've seen, where there was some really weird action that was happening on the 2nd overall pick market with Drake May.
Looks like it's floated back towards Daniels a little bit for anyone wondering. At least when
sure,
I'm
maybe
at.
You had like a little flash crash there or something.
Yeah,
some algorithmic, but like the markets can take that input and be like, oh, there's some really sharp money coming in on Drake May. We should move the odds, and then I don't know. Then maybe something changed, or I don't know. But the market can be a lot more swift reacting to those things, and so I'd say that my data is good for kind of thinking about the situation being like relatively stable. So, right now we're kind of in this little bit of uncertainty where we think there are going to be trades that happen in the draft. We just don't know who or what. We think it's going to be the Minnesota Vikings, but who are they going to trade with? Are they going to trade with the Arizona Cardinals? I think that the trade with the Cardinals logic is a little bit kind of tired based off of the multi-trade that happened last year in the draft. I don't think that's something that'll happen every year. Could it be the Patriots? The Patriots were rumoring that today. Is it going to be the Chargers, who seemingly have self-interest in getting more draft picks because they're in a different state of their team build? Is it, you know, yeah, is it the Giants, who maybe they're just like, we love Daniel Jones and we will trade down with you? So to me, it's hard to say, but the mock draft markets are good in like kind of a more stable situation, where there's not as much movement or like threat of movement. And so right now I've seen that just like there's a very kind of solid top 10 that I think is a little too solid. And some of that is because we don't have a lot of this like good information, potentially because of what's happening with the leagues kind of cramping down on people leaking sources to the media. But then also maybe we've also become wiser to leaking or like the perception of things, like the whole, you know, Trey Lance thing that you mentioned. I mean, you can tell me, and I believe what you said, that stuff came out like they do like 2 days before the draft, but I'm still seeing like some of my most accurate mock drafters, Daniel Jeremiah, Lance Erline, all having Mac Jones at 3. And so yeah, that influenced my numbers a lot. I don't see that type of conflict right now. I don't see like there's like a conflict where like if JJ McCarthy doesn't go at pick 5, he won't go until pick, you know, like where Mac went, like in the teens. So I'm intrigued, but I don't really know about the information richness of the market versus the information richness of the mock drafts, but they're kind of measuring different things, and the markets are also very much more probabilistic in nature just by their definition.
Yeah. I think that's part of it. I mean, these are typically like one way type of markets in a lot of circumstances. If you think about it, like there's going to be a hold built into everyone. So all of the implied probabilities are going to be much higher than what the actual kind of probabilities are for these picks. And it's funny, even Jeff Benson, if anyone follows him on Twitter, what's his Twitter handle? He's a good dude.
It's Circa Sports. Yeah.
Jeffrey Benson 12. Don't ask me what 12 means. And so he was on here and he basically said, which makes like rational sense, is that they lose money on the draft. Everyone loses money on the draft because this is not a situation like for their normal where they would have their own models. They would project something. They would take in a little bit of money. They would adjust, and then they would kind of come up with an almost perfect, theoretically perfect, line before an event. Here, it's all reactive. They're just reacting to what other people are doing. They can try and build in a pretty decent size hold in there, but that's all they can do. So even the markets in this case are much, much more fallible in a way and can be maybe even driven by misinformation or ideas, or like you said, a flash crash in this sort of way, than it would be for a typical betting market for another sort of outcome where you can have your own independent opinion on that and not just be reacting to who you think might know something.
Yeah, I mean, the perfect example is that NBA draft a few years ago with Paolo Banchero, where the markets were right. And there's the whole deal with Shams, where the, you know, his status as a insider kind of influenced people to make certain bets. And so I'm sure that after that happened, I mean, he was probably trying to do his job, but, you know, it turns out that, you know, yeah, you shouldn't read everything into every single, there's a lot of insiders out there too. So it's like sometimes hard to know who to trust, who has a good track record. Like there's some draft insiders and draft experts who I kind of don't even listen to because I'm not sure how credible they even are. They've just been around for a while.
Okay. One thing that I wanted to run by you, and this is an idea looking at some of the players, and if anyone's seen the consensus 2.0 mock that I have that's based upon your data from, you know, pretty recently, obviously there's been a lot of updates and there's going to be a lot of updates coming today. Today's your Super Bowl, or your draft, however you want to say it, that you have everything coming in today.
Super Bowl week, yeah.
There's a couple of players. I mean, one of them, Joe Alt, I would say, to the Titans. Another one, Dallas Turner, to the Falcons at 7 and 8, respectively. I wonder about some of these picks where we talk about like a wisdom of crowds, but when you try to translate that into probabilistic thinking, it's not quite the same. Like if something has a 90% chance of happening and you ask 100 people, do you think this is going to happen? If everyone believes that 90% chance of happening, 100% of the people are going to say that that's probably going to, you know what I mean? It's going to be closer to 100 than it's going to be to 90. In the same sort of way, what do you think about the idea for some of these picks? There's just not, and you talk about the trades earlier, this goes in the trades, like there's just the inability to really think creatively enough to put something out there, which will then be labeled as outlandish in the same sort of way. So people just default to certain picks into certain spots, and you're not necessarily getting a good like probabilistic range on there.
That's how I feel about the top 10 right now. When I look at the top 10 on Grinding the Mocks vertical board, you got Williams, Daniels, May, Harrison, McCarthy, Neighbors, Ault, Adunze, Turner, and Bowers. And I feel like that hasn't really, there's been some shifting in between in there, but like, I feel like that's kind of just a equilibrium, but like the top 10 has never been like perfect. It's never been like, oh, like, you know, I look back at that, I think it was also that 2021 class where JC Horn went, and it kind of like blew up the top 10 a little bit. Everyone's like, whoa, like didn't think that was going to happen. And then, you know, Parsons fell, and like to me, like the draft is just so much more dynamic, and I think people just get into a rhythm with these things. Like, and so to me, like Ault and Turner are kind of the poster kids for that, where there's like no way that we should be that certain that they're going to be matched with those teams. I mean, the over under for Ault is at 7, but like heavily juiced 7.5, right? But like, mm-hmm. to me, that's kind of a little bit of his floor. I think he could go a lot earlier. I think he could go at 5 if the Chargers hold that pick. And then for Turner, I think it's more likely that he could go later than 8. I don't know if he goes earlier than that because the strength of this class is not on defense, but I think it understates his, I mean, for Ault, it understates his ceiling, and for Turner, it overstates his floor. You know, to me, there's people need to be a little more creative. And I think as you get more of these expert, like big, real experts, like the Daniel Jeremiahs, the Dane Brugelers, the Lance Zierlein of the world, I'll be interested to see what they do specifically with those two players and whether that differs a lot from what we've seen in consensus or if it kind of holds. And if so, maybe people were right to be overconfident, but it doesn't mean that it was the right process.
Okay. And the other thing I would say is when we talk about certain players, I want to talk about Bowers for a second, because I've written about him a bit. He's someone where I think, according to like anecdotally, and I think looking at some of your data, that there's this idea of there's like a consensus big board type of rating that players have. And then there's a mock draft of where they think they're going to go. My like anecdotal intuition is that the earlier in the offseason, the more those things can kind of match. And then there starts to be a little bit of a spread as people start to say, you know what, Brock Bowers isn't going to go in the top 5. Okay, Brock Bowers isn't going to go necessarily in the top 7. Maybe he's not even going to go in the top 10. And we start moving on. And I think he's a good example of that. And this is a very much a positional value type of discussion. I think Kyle Hamilton was a great example of that a couple of years back, where a lot of people said, some people had him as a number 1 player in that class or top 5 player. And he kept on falling. And then the Ravens basically took him because nobody else would trade up with them at that point. And they're like, okay, well, we'll take him now that he's fallen as far as he has. So how do you think about those particular players? Do you think there's anything to that generally that you might even be able to look at a positional value type of basis and say, I don't know about quarterbacks, because I think people are getting pretty hip in moving their mock drafts to match quarterbacks. They're almost like their own category. But for some of these other positions, there could still be a lag maybe all the way into draft day with where people have them in their mock drafts based upon their big boards.
Yeah, I think it matters up to a point. So, you know, last year with the tight end class, it was supposed to be like the best tight end class ever. And it might mean that just there were higher, you know, mean players, right? Or like median projection players than there normally are. And this year we only have one guy with a high, you know, peak potential outcome. I don't think I see that with Bowers, because he's only viewed as like a top, I mean, only viewed as like a top 10 consensus player. Yeah. Whereas like Kyle Hamilton, also not viewed as a top 5 overall consensus player, but like Bijan Robinson last year, Kyle Pitts, in 21 as well, like they were both viewed as like consensus top 5 prospects. And so to me, it's a little different, because what'll happen is that, you know, if they're consensus top five, it probably means that they're in the top five on a lot of people's boards. And so once you get out of the top five, a bunch of teams are just slaves. And I think we said this last year, are just slaves to their boards. They don't necessarily think about value. They just look at, and there isn't maybe an argument to just like pick the best players, regardless of position. Maybe to me, excluding running back, there can be an argument of like, you know, you just want the best players. You want a superstar. What's the probability you get a superstar? And so we know that the probability that you get a superstar really drops outside of certain parts of the draft. That's like that, you know, Mike Lopez draft curves, aging curves, and the, you know, indexing on superstar versus indexing just on like overall mean outcome. But, you know, when I think about Bowers, I think that he will end up in the top 10 somewhere. I don't think he's going to fall outside of that. And that's because he's a top 10 player. If he does fall outside of the top 10, it will be like barely. So to me, like, I think that his potentially, I think the falling spot for him, I think he would like maybe last until 12. Because either the Broncos would take him or a team would trade up potentially to take him because he's viewed as a top 10 player and teams just really, really slaves to their boards. They don't really necessarily adjust for positional value. I think some of them might, but a lot of them, if they're just pure super scout led, then they will look at the board as the true kind of true north. And that's what we're always going to be aiming for, is maximizing picking the top player on our board, regardless of the positional value and regardless of the what the market republic thinks. In this case, the public is aligned that Bowers is a top 10 player. He's a top 10 player in my data. But all the pitfalls that you've mentioned, there was on that last episode, I thought you articulated it really well in the article that you wrote. Just, you know, the highs for tight ends are just fewer and far between. We're not as good at picking them as we think we are. You know, all I hear is, you know, watch the tape. And I'm like, well, yeah, we've watched the tape on so many guys. Watch the tape on TJ Hockenson. Watch the tape on Noah Fant. And they've all been better at the second team that drafted them, or second team that ended up with them, rather than the first, or not at all. And so just a risky proposition. It probably, I mean, Bowers could be the one, but then again, you know, I like some of the tight ends that are available in that day two period, like Ben Sinnott, who's your poster child tight end this year. For me, I really like Theo Johnson from Penn State. So, you know, I'd rather run with those guys because the cost on a cost basis, I feel like you'll get similar production on the rookie deal potentially.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see Bowers, because I think that I had this thing where I wrote in the Bowers article about, I might be a little bit different than your opinion. I mean, I see in the markets now, he's about, you know, I don't know. It's tough to view these things because it's about minus 200. So it's heavily weighted towards the under at 12 and a half. But I tend to think of NFL decision makers where here's how I see like analytics making a difference. And it's interesting. We were talking a little bit before we got on about soccer, and there was a soccer beef that went on between, not beef, but there was a soccer tactics writer, John McKenzie, and then he got some pushback from Ted Knudsen about like how much of the effect the analytics had on the fact that they were taking closer shots in soccer versus what they were before. And what McKenzie was saying, in some ways, it's right. Like, yeah, the coaches are the ones implementing it because they implement everything, right? Like, it's literally impossible for anything not to be done by the coaches. But the same thing is saying in the draft, like, yeah, the GMs are the ones doing it. You know, no one has completely usurped GMs other than maybe Kwesi and for the Vikings as making those sorts of decisions. But at the same time, like, it can provide a lot of backing to a trend that is actually happening in the NFL. And I feel like we've hit a little bit of a tipping point now with tight ends because of Kyle Pitts's, you know, not a failure, but we're talking about, you know, 1,000 yards in his rookie season, and now maybe a little bit over 1,000 over the last two seasons. And then you go back further, and we're talking about misses and misses and misses over the last 10 years. So I do start to wonder as to whether or not this could be the year where we kind of have like the analytics and the recent performance coming together to just have a few teams start to pass. And then who knows, he could end up being in the late teens or in the 20s or something like that for Bowers.
I remember last year when you talked about Robinson, you said that, you know, he, given all of the information, like where he's ranked on the boards and stuff, that you would have drafted him at the end of the first. Do you feel the same way about Bowers?
I'm working on that right now. Actually, I didn't realize that these these grades were available. I'm not sure. I have to check to see if I've said I would have drafted him the first, but I definitely had information that said this is his grade.
Yeah.
Based upon grades, I think I got from Sports Info Solutions. This is kind of like a surplus value sort of calculation. This is where you would have him. Now, the one tweak, and it's kind of on the opposite between is the opposite phenomenon between tight ends and running backs, is if you hit that super duper high outcome, normally for running backs, they're not any good on their second contracts anyway. Like, these guys are just not worth that much. The second contracts, they kind of provide a lot of surplus value early, but not so great later on. Whereas it's the opposite with tight ends. So yeah. So the early stuff that I've done, and I'm going to try to publish something tomorrow about this class, it does have Bowers as being late-ish first round, earlier second round, but you know, there's also like a opportunity cost phenomenon coming in here where you could say, yeah, even if I can get the surplus value there, I only have so many first round picks. And if I don't have like 10 of each to fill these different roster spots, then I still might move them further down if I know I really can't find some of these other positions outside of the first round.
But yeah, I think you're right. There's this like weird calculus around how he could become more valuable on a second contract than he would on his first.
Yes.
And
but he has to be like one of the top. Yes. I mean, there's only like two guys that qualify. I'm not even sure Mark Andrews really qualifies. We'll see.
He's heading that way.
Yeah, he could be heading that way too. But you know, tight end, there's a lot of injury problems with tight ends also, because they're blocking guys who are bigger than them, and then they have defensive backs diving at their knees all the time. So we do have problems there. But that's the thing. It's not only like a high end outcome, it's like literally could be absent for 5 years, a guy who even qualifies at being at that sort of level. We just happen to have had Gronk and Kittle and Kelsey recently.
Yeah, I feel like the Njoku sort of like that's kind of like best like case scenario for, I guess, for the most part, beyond the elite outcome. It seems like we don't really have a whole lot between the two. There's like either abject failure because expectations are so high. Like for example, like Hockenson, and I think eventually Pitts, if they get extended, it'll be at some the extension won't end up being like, you won't get a huge deal on them because they're just not as good. But yeah, I think it's a really interesting, it's a really interesting dichotomy between like they become less valuable on, more valuable on the second deal if they're elite, but the likelihood of being elite seems kind of low.
So. Yeah. I mean, it's funny you mentioned like Njoku. You know, he's, and this is a contract he signed a couple of years ago. At least now we're talking about $14 million-ish a year for him. Hockenson, you know, there was a trade compensation. It was a pick swap, so it wasn't that big of a trade compensation, but still trade compensation, and then signing him to a $16.5 million contract. You know, you look at those sorts of deals and you say there may be a little bit more value you're getting on those guys versus some other positions, you know, where you're just throwing money at wide receivers who are not really making that big of a difference. But it's not a lot. It's really like, again, Kelsey, Kittle, we're talking about are the guys at this point. And then also Mark Andrews. And there are some other guys where you start to look at them and you go, well, maybe they'll get re-upped at some time. But, you know, Dallas Goedert, if he can stay healthy, Mark Andrews, if he can stay healthy, those sort of guys are in that discussion too. But that's really it. So even in the above average guys still might not be underpaid that much. It's really just the top tier.
And I think people are still coping, though, because you hear like what Nate Tice said about power slot and about how he's an offensive weapon. And all I hear is how you're going to try to explain that he gets more than like three targets a game because their offense stinks. And so like whatever team he goes to, right. Or something.
Yeah.
Like, it's going to be hard. Like you have to really, and I think I said this when the Falcons drafted Pitts, like you have to play him like a wide receiver. You have to give him the targets to justify, because you could justify throwing in lots of offenses are geared to throw, you know, many, many targets, to soak wide receivers with targets. And I think that's a strength, for example, of a team like the Bengals, where they've spent a lot of money at wide receiver, and they've subsequently spent a lot of their offense targeted at wide receivers. And I said, if you wanted to make this pick worth it, you're going to have to dedicate your offense around getting targets to this guy. Obviously those things are a little bit, like there's some circular logic there. Like he's good because he gets lots of targets, not just because the offense is built to get this guy lots of targets. He also has to be good to earn those targets. And so there's a little bit of like a chicken and the egg thing is, you know, if they get targets, are they good? Or is the offense, you know, not built around getting them targets? And I just haven't really seen outside of really outside of Kansas City that there's been an offense that's really been dedicated around getting that specific player targets. And so to me, that argument falls hollow, not beyond just the argument that you had made about how high would you draft a power slot? And the answer is, I think for some people, it's in the second round. And so to me, if you want to get the best power slot of all time, you know, I still haven't seen the value of the slot receiver go up. You still draft Justin Jefferson because you think he can play outside, not just because you think he's good in the slot.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll see what happens with these guys. I think it's an interesting discussion. I do think it differs from running back in a way, in that, like, there have been obviously early busts. We talk like the Trent Richardsons of the world, but there's also been guys who've been pretty good at, like, at least Saquon as a rookie, and some others that have taken early. Ezekiel Elliott, who has taken early, who, you know, look pretty good early, so they might have given you that value. It's just you make the mistake, like the Dallas Cowboys, of giving that second contract because of all that he gives to the offense, and he's an outlier, and he's a unique sort of player that you need, and then, you know, it often falls on his face.
Even they regret it now.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Jerry Jones has said that he would have never drafted him. And because once you draft him, you kind of feel like you want to maintain, you know, keep, you have to hold on to that because you spent a top five pick on him. So
yeah,
I mean, same deal with Hawkinson.
Yeah. Let's not obscure the fact that they didn't take Jalen Ramsey and they took, they took Ezekiel Elliott. So yeah, it was a mistake early at number one, but at the same point in time, you know, he accumulated so much in production. So early on, you know, he was getting like MVP votes, I think, as a rookie and so on, that some of the mistakes really came into play there. All right, let's I want to talk quarterback some more, because, you know, that's kind of the only guys I really know about, if I'm being honest. So how do you delineate when you have mock drafts that will often say 1-2-3, 1-2-3-4 quarterbacks in some sort of order, but we know that there seems to be, like, the rank ordering, or if you're going to grade these guys on a point scale, you could have a big, almost tier drop, multiple tiers between, let's say, the number one pick and the number four pick, and they're going only three picks away from each other in rapid succession. But that also should mean in some way that number four pick has this higher probability of falling much further than we may have expected, let's say, a la Will Levis in the past. So how do you think about the quarterbacks in this draft?
Yeah, last year I had thought that Levis would be the one that he was going to be the one who would go early, and that Richardson would be the one who would fall. But I was very wrong on that. This year, I just think that the problem we have is, like, too many quarterbacks by two. So it's not just those four that you're hearing, but I'm hearing a lot about, I can't imagine the Broncos not taking a quarterback. I can't imagine the Raiders not taking a quarterback. Well, I can imagine them.
Well, the Broncos, breaking news, they have Zach Wilson now. So
it's wow. Okay. Interesting.
They're set.
What was the compensation?
It's the ham sandwich, less than a ham sandwich, because
conditional seventh round.
It was a, you know, well, close. It's a pick swap, a sixth. And then you give back a seventh also as part of that. And I think the Jets are eating some portion of his guaranteed money that's left also. So yeah.
I like it. Yeah, yeah, I like it. Former top two pick, and you get, it's worth nothing, and you get some more guys in your room. And if he stinks, then you stink again. But he has more
the
upside.
Thin air, the mile high air. He can
in
just,
theory,
you know,
he has more upside than Jarrett Stidham, right? It may not be that much more now, but in theory, he should have a higher upside than Jarrett Stidham.
Yeah, man. Of course, I'm joking here. I don't think that makes them set. At quarterback.
It does not. But there are some people who are like, I can't imagine them not taking a quarterback. I'm like,
yeah,
in the first round. Well, one of the problems the Broncos have is that they trade up too much. They traded up twice last year for Marvin Mims, who is fine, but wasn't. You know, I don't know if he's that much better than the receiver that was taken after him. And they also traded up for Riley Moss, who had like 30 snaps last year. I kid you not. Defensive back from Iowa in the third round.
Yeah.
So they lack draft capital. So I think people are kind of spamming quarterback to them. But yeah, so to me, that's the first thing. The conversation is first is Penix and Nix are being mocked heavily in the first round. And I think both of them end up somewhere in the second or third. So to me, I'm going to take an L on the data probably again, like I did last year for Hendon Hooker. And then as far as the JJ McCarthy deal, I think that he is worthy of a top half of the first round selection. He's probably rated like on the consensus big board somewhere in the teens or 20s. And to me, that means that you probably are worth it in the top 10 somewhere, because you have to give some sort of specific quarterback subsidy there. But I doubt that it's somewhere in the top five, barring a trade up. To me, it's hard to project, but my sense is that he probably might fall. He might fall outside the top five if there isn't a trade. And so there's no guarantee that there is going to be a trade. It's all about the best deal that the Vikings can swing. And if there are multiple people that I'm hearing that are saying that they're quote unquote open for business, in theory, that's good for the Vikings because they can play the market. And so I'm not surprised that Kwesi is patiently waiting to get as close to the draft as possible to get the best deal that he can get to be able to move to get McCarthy if he's there, or Drake May somehow, if Drake May falls out of that top two, or even Daniels, any of the three that's not Caleb Williams. My sense is the top three quarterbacks feels really strong. I don't think there's going to be four in a row. I would be really surprised if that happened, just because I think Marvin Harrison is considered a really like generational type of wide receiver prospect. He's probably neck and neck with Caleb Williams for being the top prospect. And it's not like in previous years where we had Ja'Marr Chase, who is considered a top five prospect, but not a number one conversation prospect. So I'm really intrigued by Harrison. I think a lot of people will be. And then there's all these people who think that Neighbors and Odunze are pretty close to them too. So like, to me, there's just so many high caliber players that, you know, are in between. And so to me, having four quarterbacks in the first round overall is really, you know, pretty high in terms of the high watermark. Having them in the top five, four in the top five, would also be a really high watermark and would be a boon for teams that don't need a quarterback outside of that. And so it's interesting, but I don't foresee four quarterbacks in a row. And I'd maybe think that McCarthy won't go in the top five. I think he will go in the top 10. I think he still has some of the things that Levis didn't have in his favor, if you want to make the comparison to them. So, you know, he's early declare. Levis was not an early declare, and Levis had a pretty underwhelming senior campaign. He had a Senior Bowl invite, but he didn't go. There was a lot of, you know, gambling like market activity, like the whole odds about him going at two. It was really interesting. I don't foresee McCarthy having the same type of draft day experience that Levis did.
Okay, so just for some, put some numbers around this, I'm looking at consensus big board information by Jack Lichtenstein at Jack Lick, L-I-C-H 10. He has some information that he puts out there. So I think you kind of nailed it, at least according to the information here. What's interesting is he actually has the McCarthy has the same big board rating as Levis did a year ago. They're both at 28. So a pretty vast step down. It goes 2, 6, 8 for the top three for Williams, May, and Daniels, and then drops down to 28 for McCarthy, and then 35 for Nix, and 38 for Penix Jr. So according to this, like, McCarthy, at least in some people's view, and I think it's being dragged down by a couple people, have him, you know, outside of the first couple of rounds, is closer to the other quarterbacks. I guess you might even call them the third or fourth tier quarterbacks, then if you put Williams in a tier of his own and then May and Daniels in the second tier. Let's do some prognosticating here that we will not be held to, because it'll ultimately be wrong. I wonder, when it comes to the Vikings, when they make this trade, they get this additional pick. You have now year three of the regime, as they like to say, of Kwesi and Kevin O'Connell there. Maybe they could survive a rebuilding year, but, you know, like, where are you going to be next year? How often are you going to have this sort of ammunition? What is the quarterback class going to look at? You didn't actually do that. You didn't make the playoffs last year, you know, right? I know you didn't have Kirk Cousins and all that other stuff, but you don't have like that much goodwill built up. The fact that they make that move to get that extra pick to think about moving up, in my opinion, means that they should be interested in a May or a Daniels as opposed to a McCarthy. Cause like, why commit yourself to potentially go and get McCarthy when there's some possibility that early on when they made that trade, that the way the tea leaves are flowing through, maybe you could just make a draft day trade for less, move up a couple of spots and get McCarthy then rather than having to wait. What do you think about my theory as far as that's concerned?
I think it's a good theory. You know, I think they, so one of the issues that the Vikings have had is that they really haven't had enough draft capital, and that's why they made certain draft day trades that have now since been criticized, like they did with the Lions when the Lions traded up with them to draft Jameson Williams, when they decided to, you know, target Lewis Cine instead of Kyle Hamilton, and Cine has been really forgettable and Hamilton has been unforgettable.
Well, I mean, if, in all fairness, Jameson Williams has been a little bit forgettable too. Brett Holmes, I'm talking
exactly.
to you.
Exactly. Yes. To you out there. Yeah. But yeah, so I think people might be surprised that Kwesi might be more interested in the discount trade that you're talking about, the mm-hmm. draft day trade. So I think he wants to be prepared for any number of situation, depending on what the price is, if he can get, because all I'm hearing is pick three is for sale, pick four is for sale, pick five is for sale. If so, then that's good for buyers, specifically quarterback buyers. And so if that was the case, then I would try to get up to three. But the I think that people might be, I'm a little skeptical of the Vikings being like, I think they could stomach a rebuilding year. It all depends on the ownership, right? The ownership is the one who makes decisions. And I think when they hired Adofo Mensah, they had this concept of this competitive rebuild where they could rebuild while being competitive at the same time. And I'm hopeful that like they take some lessons that if you can pivot in the right direction here and be cost controlled at quarterback, it may not necessarily matter too much to them. They might think that their kind of situation is a little bulletproof. You know, there's some people who believe, like the Mina Kimes of the world, that McCarthy is like a perfect Shanahan system quarterback. Mm-hmm. And O'Connell comes from the McVay tree. That's part of the Shanahan, as a branch of the Shanahan tree.
But if you're a perfect Shanahan quarterback, then why pay for the Shanahan quarterback when
there's
you
some
can
people
get
who, some people who believe
not
he's like
Shanahan that. Quarterback? And then mm-hmm. you know, it's like why be so targeted on a guy that early in the first round? In
I think
situation.
I think some people view him as more than that. I just think that some people
he's definitely more athletic, right? In a way. I mean, there was an idea. I mean, the whole Trey Lance thing never made any sense from that perspective. But he would have been able to bring something that. Supposedly, you know, I mean, you talk about Shanahan quarterbacks. I mean, Kirk Cousins was the guy they loved so much. And now they, you know, the Vikings, let's face it, they could have brought him back if they really wanted to bring him back. I think if they really would have put, but it was, in some ways, if they wanted to make the move off of him, I think they lucked out by the fact that there was another serious bidder that they could say, oh, you know, we tried, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing about McCarthy, and this is like the really interesting question I think around him, is the lack of volume. Is that a signal that he wasn't that good? But there's also this other side of the coin of that, where there is not necessarily a 100% signal in volume. There's a lot of volume that's like junk in terms of like doesn't translate, or like Bo Nix, like I forget what it was. I was talking with Mike Tenier from formerly of Football Outsiders, and now has his own Substack as well. And, you know, the Sports Info Solutions data on air yards for Bo Nix, it's like something like 25% of his yards were on passes that had air yards of zero or negative yards. So like, it's a lot of behind the lines junk. And so if I gave McCarthy a bunch of those yards too, then like, does that make him a better quarterback? And so, you know, I'm kind of in line with like the Eric Eagers of the world, where like make the sample smaller to things that seem like they're more pro translatable, then they just become a little bit more of an apples to apples sort of comparison, but you still don't feel great because the sample is small. Kind of like how, you know, we want to evaluate linemen on true pass sets, not just on things that are like RPOs or play action, where, you know, the play is a much different type of play than a true pass block. In terms of like true passing, NFL passing situations, the volume for McCarthy versus some of the other guys is actually not the numbers are a little bit less stark, and the performance is still pretty good. So I don't know, but to me, the idea of like Shanahan quarterback, it can be viewed as type of an insult, but you know, in the right system, that guy can almost win MVP.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I think for McCarthy, I'm not as concerned with the volume because number one, like I don't think college teams cater to their specific quarterback that much. And even if we're talking about cumulative volume over multiple seasons, I mean, he is a full 2 year starter as a true junior who just turned 21 in January. So it's like, hey, it's not that much more you could ask for other than saying, go back to school for another year. And
that's what people were asking for, but you know, I think that's more to make them feel comfortable about that. And he must've gotten some good advice from the NFL's, advisory committee for people who are doing the early declare, because you can ask them where you think they're going to go and they give you a range. And if they said first round, then why stay for another year? First round contract's still a first round contract.
Definitely. Okay, let's talk wide receiver next, because this is a particularly heavy class there. Hasn't always been the greatest results when we had a wide receiver heavy class. I guess we had like the 2014 class with Watkins and Evans, and at the time Odell Beckham seen as being, you know, the next coming of everything, and Brandon Cooks and all these guys that they had in that draft. And then we also had the draft class with Ja'Marr Chase and others that have been successful in that year for Waddle and Devontae Smith. Now we have a few guys here. Now the grind of the mocks information, the mock draft information, again, it's very much like Harrison and then the other guys being separate, just when we're talking about the uncertainty in range of outcomes that's coming here. The fact that you are hearing something from some, you know, things are being thrown out there via Adam Schefter from the Cardinals that they're open to business, and that, does that mean that, hey, maybe at least the Cardinals, if not other teams, are thinking they're a little bit closer? You know, it's not as stark as the contrast there. So they could say, hey, if we go down a number of spots and we can still get one of these other two guys, as opposed to getting Harrison, that's worth it for us.
I mean, I think that they come, the Cardinals last year, I think, caught a lot of people by surprise with how aggressively they moved in the trade market. And so I think people are kind of reacting to that, but who knows how much posturing is going on to try to see what kind of deal they can get. Because, you know, the Cardinals are not a perfect team. They're not like a wide receiver, one wide receiver away. They could be a wide receiver. Then if you feel like there's a difference, not big of a difference. My sense of things is that there's Harrison, and then, you know, Neighbors is kind of close by. But that Harrison is seen as more generational. And so I think that people should feel good about Harrison as a top five guy.
Is this year's generational prospect, as I like to say. For NFL, a generation is every like 18 months.
I think the conversation about him is a lot different than it has been about anybody else in the top five. And I think some of it is the bloodline, like with his dad, and
Well, they were talking about him even when the last two wide receiver classes have come out. Not only Jackson, Nanabun and Jigba came out, but even going further back when we're talking about Olave coming out and others, where it's like, oh, you know, this guy's really the best guy, and we still have, you know, he's still going to come out that much later. So he's definitely been like in the popular imagination for a very long time for a player who's coming out early.
Yeah, I think that is definitely, I think that makes him unique. Neighbors really talented. A lot of the LSU, like, to me, it's like kind of similar situation, but a little bit on more steroids than the Washington situation. Like, when we look back at the Washington team this year with Penix, he's going to have a first round wide receiver, a first round tackle, a second round tackle, a second round wide receiver, and maybe a third round wide receiver. LSU, Jaden Daniels is going to have two first round wide receivers probably. And then there's probably one of his offensive tackles will be a top pick next year. So like these guys were surrounded with this like epic talent. But yeah, it's to me, it's harder to evaluate. I think I feel much better about Harrison versus everybody else. I don't know. I think that Neighbors and Odunze are both really good prospects. And I expect them all to go in the top 10. But after that, I think it's pretty much anybody's game. Brian Thomas Jr. from LSU could go in that top 5 or top 10, sorry. But I think more likely he goes outside of it. But I think there could be as many as 7 wide receivers that go in the first round.
Yeah, I think it would be a little bit nuts if the Cardinals, if they liked another receiver other than Harrison, just stood and picked at, like, if they like Neighbors, let's say, took Neighbors there rather than trade out of Harrison? Because I'm looking at different grading and other things. There are like some public grades out here that have Harrison so high as the number one player in the class that I'm really interested into whether or not the number four pick, and like you're saying, I think it's less likely than some people think that that's going to be another quarterback in the range of quarterbacks. I don't want to see it from like, I think it's a great move, but I want to see like a Sammy Watkins style. Someone pays way too much. Someone pays way too much to say, you know what? Like the delta I see with Harrison and where I see him versus all these other receivers is so much higher than what the Cardinals see him that they go ahead and move up and give up just a ridiculous amount to move up even within the top 10 to go get Harrison.
Yeah, I think that's possible. I think it seems a little unlikely, but you never know. I can't think of a team in the top 10 that would have that type of thirst, but to me, yeah, there's not a lot of gossip about that. I think it's not a narrative that you hear a lot of people talk about.
Yeah. I mean, there's some thirsty teams up here. They need some,
Giants
could be a little thirsty if they want to keep with Daniel Jones, I guess. Bears, I don't know. Do we believe in the analytic cylinder over there and everything that they have going on that they're gonna sit tight? Who knows? They're playing with a lot of house money over the house money effect is real, right? So they got a lot of house money over there. So that could be also another interesting one. Like if they're sitting at 9 and they're saying there's no way we're going to get Harrison, but we have him so much higher ranked than these other guys, who knows? They might be willing to like throw away some draft capital because they're thinking, oh, our defense was good last year. We have all these players. We add this. We already have DJ Moore. We're, you know, our first round pick next year is going to be, you know, very low. Isn't going to be very good because we're going to be a playoff team. Blah, blah, blah.
You sound like you're talking about the Jets.
Yeah.
Would you rather the Jets make that big move for Harrison, or would you rather them take Brock Bowers? Because they both sound kind of negative EV a little bit.
But they need an offensive tackle because one of their geriatric tackles is going to break down by week 8, I think. So yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
Okay. Other positions, or any other positions that you're looking at that intrigue you the most here? I'm sticking with quarterback and wide receiver because you know I'm an offensive supremacist. But what else are you looking at here?
Looking at the offensive linemen, got a ton of them in the first round right now. I think counting them, I think the over-under potentially will be like around 10. I think that sounds right. I think we're more likely to get more wideouts than expected than to get more linemen than expected, just because the number of linemen that are expected is just so high. But yeah, I think there could be a 10. That's the kind of the record is 10 offensive linemen in the first round. And I think we'll probably stick around there like 9 or 10. I don't think we'll get 11. I think you'll see a number get kind of taken pretty early on day 2 as well. But yeah, to me, wide receiver is really interesting. But I think offensive line is interesting too, just because there's so many good players. And I can't remember a year that was so different where I heard like 3 players or more that I thought were top tackle prospects who I hear people are saying should be guards. So Fuanga from Oregon State, who's my top second ranked lineman, people have talked about him as a guard. I've heard Troy Fautanu from Washington, who was their left tackle. I've heard people talk about him at guard. Graham Barton from Duke, I've heard people talk about him as a guard. He played tackle in college. He even has been practicing at center in this class too, so he seems destined for being inside. And I've even heard a little bit about JC Latham, who I think because he played guard previously, there might be some teams that would draft him to start him at guard, kind of like Tyler Smith from the Dallas Cowboys, who's the replacement for Tyron Smith this year over there. They start him off at tackle, and then once whoever your guy playing right or left tackle moves on from the organization, you just shift him over. Yeah, to me, I'm really intrigued because I think there's a lot of really good players. I think Joe Alt has distanced himself quite a bit. I'm a big fan of Olu Fashanu, who's a DC guy. He was college teammate, or high school teammates with Caleb Williams at Gonzaga College High School, right down the street from me here in DC. There's a lot of really good linemen, some really interesting projects. Like the most interesting of the linemen is this guy, Amarius Mims from Georgia, who seems like he has all the types of traits that you want, except for he didn't play a lot in college. And so that's kind of the one where his ceiling seems to be like potentially the highest, but his floor could be really low because he might just continue to be hurt. But I'm really intrigued by the offensive line. And then I'm a little intrigued, by that tight end position just at the top, though.
Okay, there's a little bit of a talk recently about Trent Baalke, when he's not passing gas. I guess I never watched that. I never watched the video.
Too many hot mics.
Yeah. I'm sure it's hot and steamy. So he's making comments about how analytics says to never trade up, and I think anyone who's an analytics person will say, okay, for a quarterback, we're allowing that sort of thing. The other probably next most closest thing, which I'm not sure you could ever get to still saying yes, you would trade up, would be premium position. So I would say like pass rushing, defensive tackle, edge rusher, offensive tackle is about it, right? Left tackle. I don't think so. Because you can get them later. You can get them. I mean, you can get them in the second round and third round. Sure. There's been a lot of guys who have been there's more you can get there. So those positions, and you're somehow magically jumping up and getting like a tier, the last person in a tier, and leapfrogging others for this sort of position. That I think a lot of people who are not hardcore ideologues like myself would say, okay, that's somewhat acceptable. I'm thinking like who was it? Was it Jordan Davis? I think it was. Yeah, I think it was Jordan Davis that the Eagles traded up to get. Well, people said, oh, you're getting this like special type of player, so therefore trading up is okay in that sort of circumstance. Of course, you know, the Eagles also traded up for Andre Dillard and people were victory lapping, that sort of thing. And that didn't end up going so well. So with this offensive tackle class, I'm wondering if that will be the spot that people feel like in different tiering, it's a premium position. There's a bunch of guys, there might be differing opinions there. Like how much, what do you think about the concept of trading up for these sorts of positions? And are there like delineated tiers even within these first round guys?
Yeah, a little bit. So I think there was a really interesting talk at the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference this year by Eric Eager, your
Never
former
heard of
PFF colleague. Yeah, I know, right?
Crazy. Yeah. He tweets about Clay Travis a little too often. Sorry, Eric. I've told you that in person, but go ahead.
Yeah, you should see him on Facebook. But yes, the Eric gave a great talk about the Sumer Sports draft dashboard at the Sloan Conference. And what they've managed to do at Sumer Sports is to be able to put dollar values and kind of speak in this common language about how much a projected player could be worth at a certain pick, based on like future simulations of future performance and future contract value, to come up with this concept of roster value. And so you can value draft picks as money, you can end up valuing the players as money, and you can look to see if it makes sense from a cost benefit perspective, including discount rates and stuff, all these different kind of funky financial calculations, to come up with these actual dollar values of what the player would be worth and how much the trade compensation would be worth. And you can play around with all kinds of sliders about what the discount rate is of this and the potential variance of that. And so I think that type of, that could be a way of valuing this type of things and kind of coming up with these trades that could end up being positive EV, depending on how well you grade the player. And so to me, it's alt at the top, really at the top. I think if the Chargers end up staying where they are, I think that's like really interesting because they really need is a right tackle. They have Rashawn Slater from Northwestern, who they drafted, in that same 2021 class, who's been hurt a little bit, but he's their left tackle. And Joe Alt seems like a surefire left tackle. So the question is, which one of them do you want to move to the right side? And so to me, I've always thought that this guy Fuanga from Oregon State would be kind of the perfect right tackle complement for them. But to me, Joe Alt kind of sits on his own as the premier left tackle player. But then you have Fuanga, who's like a right tackle, JC Latham, who I think people view as a potential like right tackle as well, played left tackle at Alabama, Fashanu, who had a really, really strong, redshirt sophomore campaign. He could have come out in the draft last year. I think he would have been the number one tackle last year. Instead, he decided to go back to Penn State and get his degree. And so he kind of fell from grace a little bit. He's not going to be the top tackle in this class most likely, but there kind of is Alt. And then I could see a bunch of different players go in between. I think I really only feel good about Joe Alt as the top tackle. And then in between, there's, I think, a lot of varying opinions. Like I said, some analysts think that some of these guys would be good guards, But I think that, you know, they should all have an opportunity to fail at tackle. Even a guy like Graham Barton, who I think will almost assuredly play at center or guard, versus some of the other ones where I think there's even a chance that some of them end up playing tackle for sure.
Okay. And, you know, we discussed this also a little bit beforehand. So I'll let you out of here with, is anything different about this? Is this the most uncertain class ever? Or is this like the generational prospect where every other year is the most uncertain ever? Because and then the theory behind this, underpinning some of this, I've seen my man Cleve T.A. Mention this about, well, you know, betting's in here. The NFL is cracking down. They really don't want anyone to know anything. So we're in a different situation. And maybe it indicates true ambivalence on the part of the Commanders. Or is it something real? Whereas opposed to maybe if we go back to, I don't know, 2016 or even Trevor Lawrence and Zach Wilson, everyone knew exactly what was happening in those two drafts with the first two picks very early on. It seemed like there's a little bit less to know now. What do you think?
I'm of the belief that whenever someone says that the draft is like really unpredictable, it ends up being a bit more predictable than we thought. To me, what makes a draft unpredictable is when there's a moment in the draft where if it happens, it changes the entire dynamic of the round. But oftentimes you don't really see that type of thing where like it truly like, so for example, you know, last year, Devin Witherspoon from the cornerback from Illinois went really early to Seattle at 5. And that changed a little bit of the first round, how it shook out in terms of where the cornerbacks went. But I don't think it necessarily changed the draft in a real way. Like, I think you'd have to see, like,
supposedly the Lions were going to draft and they wouldn't have traded back if he was still available. That's what the word on the street was. But, you know, they still got Jahmyr Gibbs and were fist-bumping.
Yes. You know, and they could have taken Christian Gonzalez, who would have was there the second they really needed cornerback. True. And instead he went all the way down Patriots. But I don't necessarily see the draft this year with that type of moment where there's going to be like a key moment where like things change, or like, you know, last year there was this run on receivers and that really changed the complexion of what the draft looked like. Cause I thought some of those receivers would fall, specifically Quentin Johnston. And he went, you know, right after on a big wide receiver run. Unless that's the type of thing that happens, but that didn't necessarily change the complexion in a meaningful way. I still had 26 of 32 first round picks in my top 32. So to me, when I hear unpredictable, it might be unpredictable at the micro level. Like, oh, we're not going to get as many direct picks, right? But I know my data has almost never been that great at getting a lot of direct picks. It's always been good about being around and trying to come up with the range of outcomes where players will get drafted. And then in between there are these, you know, probabilities. And so from my perspective, I view the draft as every year I kind of get anxious, like, oh my God, like, what are my numbers going to look like? And in the end, it usually is pretty solid because people still know how to evaluate first round talent. And so that hasn't changed. I don't think that the wisdom of crowds doesn't rely on any one individual person being right. It relies on the crowd being right. And so the crowd has mostly been right on this first round order. It's also been pretty good at predicting the order of players taken at position, not necessarily getting what the pick number is, but it's been pretty good at getting, you know, the top 100 too. So like, yeah, I don't foresee that changing too much. I see whenever I hear like this is a really uncertain draft, that kind of leads me to believe that people are just lack imagination.
Yeah, it could just be a quarterback thing too about the top of the draft. Okay, thank you so much for joining me. The data powering the consensus mock drafts. Tell the people who are interested in here, because trust me, there's some movers and shakers who are subscribing to Unexpected Plays.
Good.
At the very, well, I mean, I'm working backwards on looking at like last name, first initial combinations at NFL team who are so I should leak some of those out there, but I won't. But yeah, there may be an NFL GM who has signed up.
All recently. Right, that's pretty cool. Don't leak the PII. But yeah, so you know, you can find Grinding the Mocks at grindingthemocks.com. That's where you can find my top 50 board with vertical and horizontal board, as well as all my player charts that are of those top 50 players. And you can find the home on socials at Grinding Mocks on Twitter. And you know, if you want to find me, you know, you can reach out there. I'm all ears for folks from the team side. it's a very interesting time of year for them. There's a lot of work. This is a big culmination of work for me, but also for the teams as we lead into the draft this week. It's like a Super Bowl type of feeling for me about this time of year. And so I'm very excited to be able to share like the final works with everybody and do more research on this as the off season goes on. So please look out for all kinds of stuff that I have going on this week, whether it's stuff that's going on with you here at Unexpected Points or on my app, grindingthemocks.com.
Now, first off, I need to find you again on the mean streets of Washington, D.C., so we can go catch United or Spirit match or something like that. Yes. Trinity Rodman, electric. Number two, am I going to get you back here later after the draft to talk?
Yes.
So we'll talk later this week to review everything, discuss how everything went perfectly according to how we said it was going to go and everyone else was wrong. But until then, I'll talk to you later this week and everyone else tuning in, at least one more time. I may even throw a solo pod in here this week, to wrap everything up at the latest, next Monday to go through all my draft grades and everything else. Till then, I'll be talking to everyone later. Thanks so much.